Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Christine Cattano. Cattano received an MFA in creative writing from Syracuse University and a PhD in English and creative writing from Texas Tech University. She is the author of two collections of poetry, Birds of Paradise and her just-released Sky Country, published by BOA Editions. Cattano is currently an assistant professor of creative writing, poetry, and Asian American literature at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. And welcome to the show.
Hi, Tish. Thanks for having me.
Now, I always like to start out asking, what was it that drew you to poetry in the first place?
I think I was always a reader. I enjoyed reading, but I mostly read novels when I was a kid. And then when I went off to college, I thought, oh, I want to write novels. I want to write fiction. But I was lucky to go to a college that required that creative writing majors had to take poetry classes. And I had a very good teacher for my intro to poetry class, Chris Buckley. And he told me, I think you can really be a poet. And it was him giving me that confidence that I think brought me over into poetry.
Wow, what a nice thing to hear.
Yes.
I think you might be a poet.
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, you have said that your first collection was more autobiographical, but this current collection is definitely a lot about your family. So tell us a little bit about your family. Interesting immigration stories. Tell us.
Yeah, certainly. So autobiographically, my mother is Korean, and she immigrated from Korea when she was 16 years old. And so I grew up in Los Angeles, but my grandmother and my family lived in Koreatown. So I spent a lot of time growing up around Korean culture and Korean food and Korean language. I went to a Korean language school on Saturdays. So I felt very connected to the Korean side of my family. On the other hand, my name is Christine Cattano, and so I also definitely identify as being Japanese American, even though culturally I didn't always feel as connected to that part of the family. But my father was incarcerated during World War II at Topaz Incarceration Camp in Utah, and that was always a story that was vibrant in my family. It was things that people talked about. I was lucky to have a family where people were comfortable talking about it, because there are a lot of Japanese American families where they don't want to talk about those stories. But my father was a scholar and a professor, and so I think he knew that it was important to pass those stories on.
Yeah, well, what an interesting family. Wow. That's amazing to me. Now, to tell us a little bit about the title of the book, Sky Country. Mm-hmm. You said it has a different meaning in Korean.
Well, it's just a translation of the word heaven. So in Korean, the word is Hanonara, and that translates literally to sky country. And in Korean, it's just the everyday word for heaven. But I just liked the kenning, that it was those two combined words, and it felt right for this collection. It was about the idealized idea of coming to America, that it was going to be this paradise. And then once you get to where you think is paradise, obviously reality is a little bit different than what you imagined.
Absolutely. And it continues to be a little different than all of us have envisioned what it could be. Now, do you feel like it's now more important than ever in this cultural point in time for the personal to actually be political?
I think it's always important for the personal to be political. The personal is always political. You know, I couldn't have timed this book at all. I probably finished the major revisions about 2 years ago. Mm. And then as the years went by and it was going to be published and political things started happening, I did feel like it was such an important time for the book to come out. I felt like people were forgetting about our history. They were forgetting about the Japanese American incarceration. And then those topics, unfortunately, became much more relevant.
Yeah.
So I'm glad the book is out there when it is.
Yeah, it's absolutely timely at this point. It's a wonderful collection. Let's have you read a poem from Sky Country. This one's called Equinox.
All right.
And you want to tell us a little tiny bit about it before you read it?
So the poems that speak to the incarceration in this collection are mostly persona poems. And so I imagined a persona of a young mother who was sent away to camp. And I was thinking about what it would be like to be of the first generation. So this character I have in mind actually immigrated from Japan to the United States, chose the United States as her home, and then was incarcerated by the United States. So that was the character I was working with in this poem. So I'll read it. Equinox. Blame the late storm, or blame the earth itself. ice-stunned soil smothering the torn green shoots. Once we lived, but now, an empty house, an empty field, an orchard emptying of fruit. At home so long, then by dawn, we were gone. This dawn, Utah's mountains trimmed with a thin purple cold. But even this winter eases into spring. Elsewhere, water must rush forth. Mist clears, leaves must brighten to green. With or without permission, another season will pass. The fence leans its shadow, but for how long can one stand against what the natural world springs toward?
I love that last line especially. That's so powerful.
Thank you.
Do you actually, is that something that you believe? It almost sounds like you believe that history is already written, and whatever we do, it might not matter, you know, how what the natural world leans toward. It's like we have no control.
It's not so much that we have no control, but I think there's always movement, no matter what. And that was what I was thinking about in this poem. When I was writing these poems, I wanted to very much avoid presenting the speaker as a victim.
Mm.
And so I was trying to imagine what could prevent that, what type of hope could she find. And I was thinking, under these circumstances, you would still see the changing of the seasons. You would still see that there's a cyclical nature to things. And so everything that has negative aspects to it might somehow become positive in some way. And so I saw her turning to the natural world for hope or comfort in this moment.
Yeah, that's a beautiful piece. Do you think people write poetry to distill experience and try to distill experiences they haven't even had? It seems to me that you're trying to do this with some of these.
Yeah, I think so. Again, when I was thinking about this collection as a whole, I wanted to step outside my immediate personal experience. Obviously, it's still very autobiographical, and that I'm writing about stories that speak to immediate family experience, but I didn't want to write so much about myself. I wanted to imagine what it would be like to be another person. And then, of course, every poem is still personal, and every poem is still about me in some way, but I just wanted to see what it would be like to imagine someone else's experience more vividly.
Yeah. So your family must have been telling stories all through your childhood, all through your
yes.
life,
yes.
right? Well, were you taking notes, do you think, somewhere subconsciously, or were you literally taking notes?
Not literally taking notes, definitely not. But I really enjoyed listening to my family speak. Especially my father's side of the family, we didn't see them that often. So when I did see them, they would often reminisce about old times being in camp or other things. And I cherished those moments. And so I think I held those stories and memories close. And then when I went to write these poems, I would say the actual events from my family history don't necessarily show up. But I had that impulse. And so I went and did research and found out about other stories and brought that all into creating the speaker for these poems.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's have you read another piece from Sky Country. This
All
one's
right.
called Leaving California.
All right.
And I particularly like this one.
Okay.
You want to tell us a bit about it first?
Oh, sure. So Leaving California, I'm so glad that you like this poem. This is probably a poem that I worked on the longest in this collection. It's probably one of the first poems I wrote for the collection. And this was, again, a very conscious move on my part to try to step outside. And so I'm from California, so I think even the title, I was trying to force myself to step outside the personal in some way. So I'll read it, Leaving California. Nothing has changed yet. The moon fades. Stars recede into their star-shaped pockets, and the sun, almost early, swells the slots between the California hills. You'll go, not today, but already you know the ocean that tugs you west toward an unknown home, the slow-drawn bow of this coast, subtle but taut and waiting.
I wanted to ask you this after reading this collection. Do you feel like in some ways you inherited a kind of homesickness from your family of, you know, the history displaced by history, but it's the ghosts are still there?
That's an interesting thought. I think we all inherit a sense of homesickness in some way. In my case, probably from that displacement, from the immigration stories, from immigrating and then being torn from that home and put in a camp and then I mean, the phrase, you can never go home again, is something I always think about, that you're always changing, your home is always changing, and your definitions of home are always changing. And in fact, the class I'm teaching right now at Ithaca College is called Homesick, so that's definitely a theme that I have constantly going in my head.
Yeah. I mean, you actually talk a lot about your father's incarceration in the mm-hmm. in the Topaz concentration camp in Utah, which to me it's just unbelievable that this country did this kind of thing still, you know. Mm-hmm. You said he spent a lot of time talking about it and learning about it and teaching about it, mm-hmm. and you said that was really good for you.
Yes.
To tell us why.
I was so lucky to have a father who was a scholar. And so he had his personal experiences, but he also researched the effects of the incarceration on the Japanese American community. And he was older. He was 60 when I was born. And so we weren't always very close on a personal level, but I would go to his lectures when he was teaching, and I would sit and listen to him talk. And that was how I learned the most about him. And then after he passed away when I was 17, again, I was lucky that he had written so much. And even in his more research-based work, he would still have personal anecdotes that would talk about his own experience in camp. And I feel really lucky to have those artifacts that I can go back to when I'm trying to write my own stories.
Yeah. Did your father talk a lot about the racism in this country and wanted you to carry on fighting for human rights in the world?
No, I was really young. He was never very vocal about things like that. But I think I learned still so much from him, from his patience and his research. And I think he really believed that doing this type of work, even in the academic or scholarly side of things, would eventually add toward the momentum to make actual change in the world.
Yeah,
and I think that's part of what I inherited, sort of the belief that art and literature and scholarship can have a real impact.
Yeah. Do you think poetry can change the world?
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, if I said no, then why would I even, why try? And I think that every poet deep down has to believe that poetry is capable of it, even if it's very hard to see its direct effects.
Yeah, yeah. So you feel like all of your family stories were filtered down to you, and you synthesized them as a poet in many ways, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to be able to deal with the world. You know, I mean, because a lot of people would absorb stories like this and turn into anger, or, you know, turn it into their own sickness or, mm-hmm. or something that, you know, some kind of rage that they wouldn't know what to do with. I find it really interesting that you can turn it into poetry.
Oh, yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christine Catano. She is a poet, and her new book, Sky Country, just came out, and we're discussing it, and I'm having her read from it. And I'd like to have you read another piece, actually, right now from Sky Country. This one's called Ancestors. Tell us a little bit about it.
So Ancestors, for the past few years, I've been lucky to be doing some work in Hawaii and learning about the Japanese immigration to Hawaii. And they've had a very different history from those of us here on the mainland. And there's something about, at least for me, thinking about the bravery of the Japanese people who decided we're just going to go to this completely unknown place and work in fields and work on the plantation and start this entirely new life. And now the Japanese American community in Hawaii is flourishing, but it required them to leave behind everything they had known. And I was thinking about that story when I was writing some of these poems about Hawaii, and so this is one of those poems. Ancestors. You'd like to imagine them at sea now, having grown tired of haunting your sleep. Perhaps they've held their words so long they can now breathe underwater, their feet webbed, their bodies edged with ocean lace. On your way to the fields, you call to them, and sometimes they call back. You pray they can see the sky above the water's surface, and that they forgive the ocean, the field upon field of space, the exact span of a daughter's disobedience.
That's a really haunting one. I loved it.
Oh, thank you.
You say that your father died quite a few years ago, but how has your family reacted to some of this poetry? Have you shown it to them?
Yes, I show them my poems.
How do they feel about it?
I think overall they're just really happy. They like that I'm writing. They like that I've found a job that I enjoy that allows me to write. And sometimes they ask me specific questions about this poem or that poem, but usually those are very minor questions, and usually they have to do with personas that have nothing to do with my actual life, and that's usually what they have questions about, and that, uh-huh. Did that really happen, or do you really feel that way? And I'll say, well, I know what it's like to feel that way, but that specific situation didn't happen to me.
Uh-huh. So they worry about some of the experiences you write about. That's interesting. I take it you must still have relatives in South Korea, right?
No one that I'm in touch with.
Really?
But there are a few family members there, but no one that I really know.
Oh, because I was wondering how people were reacting to what's happening in the world right now.
Oh.
With North Korea's threat and the U.S.'s belligerence happening right now.
Yeah.
It's a scary time to be in any country right now.
In any country. I mean, my sense is that South Koreans are fairly accustomed to the actions of the North. And even though I think over here it seems like an intensification, it seems like they're not, at least the people on the ground are not as concerned. But
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I guess you get immune to threats.
I suppose,
you say,
<yeah.
laughs> life goes on, there's nothing we can do about it, mm-hmm. I suppose, yeah. Let's have you read another, this is another personal family history piece, of course, called South Korea, mm-hmm. and it's part of a long poem, right? It's,
yes.
It's a small fragment of a longer poem.
Yes.
You want to tell us a bit about it?
So this is just a section from a longer poem called A Story With No Moral, and this longer prose poem interweaves the story of my mother and her experience growing up in Korea and my experience as a child growing up in Los Angeles. So this section takes place in Korea. So it's called South Korea, 1958. It isn't that my mother's family is poor, but that there is nothing to buy. American goods can be bribed from soldiers, but my mother has no one to barter on her behalf. My grandmother's concerns are elsewhere. In the newly partitioned country, she's obsessed with claiming land. Her eyes scan the empty spaces left behind by war, and she envisions buildings, storefronts, apartments, or hotels. In the torn fields behind her house, she crouches down to grip the soil in her hands. My mother craves the little objects that money or care can buy, a toy kitchen set, a banana, a can of Del Monte peaches and sweet syrup. She sits in her school desk, tugging at the coarse wool stockings that my grandmother buys cheap in bulk. The winter outside is bitter, my mother's exposed face raw from the cold. A classmate slides into the seat beside her and reveals in her mittened palm American lip balm in a round tube. How miraculous that such a thing even exists.
Wow, that goes back to that, the thought of the land of milk and honey that America would be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of a sad poem to me.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
It really is. How do you write? Do you write down fragments? Do you throw things in the drawer and go back to them? How do you do that?
I'll say that most of the poems in here came from a very specific strategy, which was to read poems that I loved. And if there was a poem that I really liked, I liked an image or I liked the strategy, I would write it out on a piece of paper and then start rearranging those lines and erasing lines and then trying to insert my own language into it.
Wow.
And then during that process, I would finally get to a point where most of the language was my own, and then I would continue to revise and revise until it was finally my own poem. But I really feel like the only way for me to write a poem, at least at this point, is to insert my ideas into someone else's poem. And so I find another poem that I love, and I try to write that poem only about my own subject matter.
What an interesting... I've never heard anybody say that. That's almost like, you know, a lot of people say I'm out in the woods. But you've turned poetry and into your landscape that you can rearrange.
For the most part, yeah.
Wow. What poets have influenced you?
A lot of the poems in here came from the poet Peter Everwine. He was a Fresno poet, so he was in California, and he has just these very sparse poems, but with beautiful images and beautiful turns of phrase, and the logic just moves so seamlessly through those poems. So that was something I wanted to borrow. So I would read a lot of his poems and just try to copy that style in some way. So Peter Everwine was great. I would read Polish poets in translation, so Szymborska or Miłosz, poets who had lived through very difficult times in Europe. And so I think there was something about their structure that spoke to what I was trying to speak to. And so I could borrow that style in some way.
Wow. So you're retranslating in some ways into
your own.
I had never heard anybody say that.
That's my only secret to writing.
So you do teach poetry and creative writing at Ithaca College. Well, what is it that you're trying to instill in your students?
Right now, I'm teaching a class that looks at the old masters of the American canon. So we just finished up looking at Whitman. We're going to read Dickinson. We're going to read Robert Frost, William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens. And I'm putting those up against contemporary collections. Mm. So we're reading collections that have just come out this year, some collections I haven't even had to read yet. And I want to see what we can learn from that. What about the tradition still exists? Is it still necessary to read Whitman? I think it is.
Oh, yeah.
But I want them to make that discovery for themselves, hopefully, if they see any connections between the old poets and the present. So I want them to start to trace for themselves the Western tradition, and so that they understand what they're looking for in a poem.
Wow, that's an interesting way of doing it. I am so thrilled that some of those old poets are still relevant.
Yes.
You know, I mean, just like when I got into radio in the 80s, they said radio's going to be dead.
No.
People have said poetry's going to be dead, too, especially in this era of, you know, 140 characters. People aren't going to want to read a real poem. Yeah. That's not true. Now, are you a writer who wishes you could make a living as a poet and not have to teach and not have to do, you know, distracting other world things?
I'm a person who needs structure.
Mm.
So if I were to be at a point in my life where all I had to do all day was write a poem, I think that would be a little overwhelming for me. So I like the structure that teaching brings me. I also like the rigor that teaching forces me to have with my work and other people's work. And I think I find all of that very helpful to my writing process.
Do you share your poetry with your students?
I haven't yet.
Ah.
Maybe I will.
I'm sure some of them are going to come up to you now with the new book because it's getting publicity.
Yeah, we'll see.
I think that'd be great. I think it's wonderful to have a teacher who's actually a published poet or a published writer. You know, some people who teach English and so on have never really published. So it seems much more valid to me
if you
can publish. what do you think about live performance in regard to poetry? Some people think it's still an art that should be read aloud. How do you feel about that?
I think there's definitely a resurgence of value put on live performance. I think one of the most popular clubs at Ithaca College right now is Spit That, which is the spoken word poetry club. Mm. And that's something students are always asking for. They want to learn how to do that. And I don't feel like I can teach that because I think performance poetry is its own art, one that I'm not really prepared to teach or to do on my own. I think a poem that is written well on the page will also be performed well. I don't think there's anything that different in the actual writing of the poem, but I think performance is its own genre.
Yeah.
And I think it's great that people are getting more interested in poetry, whether it be performance or on the page.
Yeah, because I do think it, in some ways, it does need to be taught, though, or practiced.
Yes.
You know, because I have heard poets who destroy their poems because they don't know how to phrase out loud correctly, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I tell people to take acting classes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people have asked me what kind of, you know, theories do I have on it. I think taking acting classes or, you know, even speaking, public speaking classes would help.
Oh, yeah,
because
that's a good point.
I think poetry can be, any written word can be a little bit misread if somebody reads it with the incorrect phrasing.
Yes, and, that's true.
And
that's
stuff.
True.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what have you learned from your students? Have you changed in any way as a poet, as a teacher?
What have I learned from my students? I learn so much from them. I learn that they're really resilient in some ways, that it's okay to push them. When I first started teaching, especially creative writing, I think it was really hard for me to figure out how to offer critiques because I was so worried about not disappointing them, but making them feel like they weren't good poets in some way. And so I've been learning that the more you push a student, the more they're willing to hear that critique. And I think that's important for me to know as a professor, and also for me to remember for myself as a poet, to be brutal with myself, to if I see lines that don't feel right to me, that I should just cut them or actually take a very hard look at them and decide what I want to do. So resiliency, I guess, is what I've learned mostly from my students.
Do you tell students to write about what they know about, or, you know, the old adage that people shouldn't try to create false narratives?
No, that has never really rung true for me. I think everything you write is something that you know about in some way. And if you don't know about it, then you learn about it by writing about it. I think there's something to be said about starting with the personal. You might have a more immediate connection to your subject matter, which is always helpful when you're starting out writing. But once you do that, I think you need to reach beyond your immediate experience to grow as a writer.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the reasons why students want to be poets nowadays? Obviously, it's not a way to make a living. Are there really dramatic reasons why people want to get into this?
I will say that I have a freshman student right now who says he wants to be the poet laureate. That's his dream.
Of the United States or of Tompkins County?
Of the United States, I assume. And I was curious about that. I said, really? And he said, yeah, I love poetry. And he just loves to read. And there are still plenty of people out there like that. I think we feel like this generation is being taken over by social media and wanting to be consultants or whatever the it thing is. But there's still plenty of people out there who love to read and will continue to love to read.
Yeah, and then want to write. I'm so glad.
And then therefore will want to write, yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time. What do you want people to take from this new collection after they've read the whole thing?
Well, I hope that people will read this and hear a voice. That's really what I'm trying to do as a poet. I hope they hear a unique person speaking to them. And from that, they can do what they will. But I hope that my voice comes across on the page.
Do you want people to sort of obtain a curiosity about history, too?
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. But I think that has to come from feeling like that there's a real person who's talking to you. Mm-hmm. So if that can come across in any way, that would be great.
Well, Christine Catano, we're almost out of time. Can you give some contact information, website, a way people can get in touch?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I have a website, which is just my name, www.christinecatano. That's christinecatano.com.
And they can reach you. And I'm sure you're on Facebook.
Yes, and I am on Facebook.
Yeah, so you can reach her. Get in touch with her. Get this collection. Again, I've been talking to poet Christine Catano, and her new collection is just out. It's called Sky Country. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.